is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by 10,000 Villages. 10,000 Villages' 13th annual showcase of Fair Trade Oriental Rugs will be held March 9th through the 12th at their store, 105 North Walnut in downtown Champaign. On Thursday, March 10th at 7 p.m., an informal seminar about Oriental Rugs will be held at the store. For more information, call 352-8200.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today, an amazing story, an incredible story that is not a story of fiction. It is a true story, the story that we'll hear this afternoon, a story of transformation, the transformation of Lev Nusenbaum, also known as Esad Bey, also known as Kurban Said. It is also a story of survival. Lev Nusenbaum transformed himself from Jew to Muslim prince and became a best-selling author in Nazi Germany. Our guest this afternoon is journalist Tom Reese. He's the author of The Orientalist, Solving the Mystery of a Strange and Dangerous Life. Reese says Lev Nusenbaum lived at the darkest moment of the last century. To quote Reese, essentially, Lev was caught between one revolution in Russia and another in Germany, which called itself by a different name. Entire empires would disappear without a trace in the space of a few years, and many people wouldn't survive them, or like Lev, they would never really stop running for their lives. Those sentences come from the introduction to The Orientalist. Like the empires that disappeared, Lev Nusenbaum's story went missing too, but this afternoon, thanks to Tom Reese, we'll get a glimpse inside. Listeners, you can join the discussion with a telephone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Tom Reese's articles about politics and culture have appeared in several publications, including The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and The New Yorker. His book, The Orientalist, Solving the Mystery of a Strange and Dangerous Life, is published by Random House. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Tom Reese, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, Celeste. It's good to be here.
You're joining us this afternoon from Chicago?
I am indeed, yes.
Where will you be in the Chicago area today?
Oh, you know, I'm going to be reading at, I guess, 57th Street Books this evening.
Okay.
And that's at 7 o'clock. Hopefully, if the weather lets up a little bit, some people will be able to come out.
Sure. Those Chicagoans are tough.
You guys are tough, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, so if folks are listening in the Chicago area and they'd like to meet you later today, they have that opportunity.
I would love it to meet anybody, yeah.
Well, first, tell us about the phenomenon of the Orientalist and the Jewish Orientalist.
Well, I mean, it's first of all, as you said, this character, Lev Nusenbaum, really transformed himself quite deliberately into a Muslim prince and a sort of desert warrior and a sort of Indiana Jones figure. A real-life Indiana Jones figure in the 20s and 30s in Europe, and he did it by taking on this identity via something that I call Jewish Orientalism, which was an offshoot of Orientalism, which at the time was seen as a whole kind of specialty, both an academic specialty on the one hand and also a kind of almost life pursuit or lifestyle choice that some people made to kind of immerse themselves in the East and in the Orient, and that could be defined in various ways for people depending on which kind of Orientalist it was. So you could be obsessed with the East and India and China, but there was a whole kind of movement of people who were obsessed with specifically the Islamic East and the Middle East and especially stretching into the Ottoman Empire and the Persian Empire. And some of these people, I mean, probably the most famous example that's still with us would be Lawrence of Arabia. But there were actually pioneers before Lawrence who were, in a way, much more important to opening up the East and who had less of a kind of direct imperial relationship with it. They weren't going in as representatives of the British government. Interestingly enough, these men were usually Jewish, and they came from different European countries starting in the mid-19th century, and they went to the East, I would say, really, as a kind of direct response to the rise of anti-Semitism in Europe. And the reason being that the real crux of European anti-Semitism, what led to to Nazism, was this idea that the Jews in Europe were an alien Eastern people, that they were an Oriental people that couldn't be assimilated into the West, that no matter how much they tried to be French or German or English, they would somehow always have this Eastern thing inside them that the anti-Semites, the people who hated the Jews, said was corrupting. And it was they had to be expelled from Europe because they were Oriental. Well, the Jewish Orientalists took this idea and turned it on its head, and they said, instead of trying to assimilate more, they said, yes, we are foreigners in a sense. We are Eastern people, even though we've been living here since just after the time of Christ. It doesn't matter. We actually are Eastern, but we embrace this identity, and we're going to go to the East, to the Middle East especially, and sort of rediscover ourselves by connecting with the Arab world and the Muslim world. And that's partly what's so fascinating and kind of through the looking glass for us now to think, I mean, with the whole way that the conflict in the Middle East between Israel and the Muslim countries, it's hard to imagine that 100 years ago, the Jewish Orientalists went to the Middle East and they saw themselves as the lost cousins of the Muslims, as probably the first prominent Jewish Orientalist, the British Prime Minister, Benjamin Disraeli, Jewish Prime Minister of England, said in the mid-19th century, the Arabs are only Jews on horseback. And Disraeli was sort of a precursor of the idea that he wasn't a Zionist, but he was, like these other Jewish Orientalists, someone who thought that the Jews had a very special role to return to the Middle East and almost act as ambassadors between the Islamic world and the world of the West.
So this pan-Semitic, pro-Muslim worldview, how was it that it eventually got swept off the table?
Well, I mean, that's the fascinating and tragic story of the early 20th century, especially sort of seen through the eyes of a kind of incredible character like Lev Nissenbaum, because it was swept off by one revolution after another, by two world wars, and really by a whole host of complex kinds of ideological violence that descended on the Jews and then also on the Muslim world. The interesting thing about our character, Lev Nissenbaum, is that he was really there at kind of every hot point. He really did live his short adventurous life on the run, and he managed to somehow run through the most important points. He was in the Ottoman Empire just as it was collapsing. Then he went to Nazi Germany just during its rise. And then he was very involved with the whole Nazi effort or fascist effort to subvert the Middle East and, in fact, sow division between Muslims and Jews. And by the way, thank you, Celeste, for emphasizing that it's a true story at the outset, because the story itself is so fantastic. I've written a biography of this man, but the man, his life is so kind of stranger than fiction that I just went into a bookstore in Barnes & Noble when I was in Boston a couple of days ago, and of course I found The Orientalist filed under New Fiction.
Oh.
And to get them to actually file it where it should be under Nonfiction, I went up to the manager and I showed him that the book has actually, you know, 75 pages of detailed notes and primary sources, which I deliberately put in I spent almost a year just getting the sources for this book in order and making them very carefully documented, because I knew this tale was so strange that for people not to think it was just a novel, I had to present every bit of evidence. And really what I've done for the last 7 years of this quest is go around the world trying to find pieces of hard evidence to separate fact from fiction in this mysterious and bizarre life.
Yeah. Well, I was reading the book and I looked up and I said to my husband, what was it that Churchill said about Russia? A riddle wrapped in a mystery inside
exactly,
an enigma.
Yeah. Yes, it all begins in Tsarist Russia. Yeah. So much begins in Tsarist Russia, and also so much of Nazi, of what would happen in Nazi Europe begins in Tsarist Russia.
Yeah.
Which is something that you see very much following Lev's journey, because Lev just comes upon the era from such an unusually Eastern perspective, and that's why maybe it's helpful to sort of even begin by talking about his quest a bit, so that one, or his initial trek. He made this amazing escape from revolutionary Russia when he was about 13 years old that took him around the world.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Well, Lev was born exactly 100 years ago now. He was born in 1905 in this oil boom city at the southern edge of the Tsarist Empire called Baku, on the Iranian border, on the Caspian Sea. And Baku, at the time Lev was born there, was the fastest growing industrial center in the world, which is quite remarkable. Yet another thing that's forgotten, Baku was the world's first oil boom city, and it was the industrial heart of the Tsarist Empire, and because of that, it was also the heart of communist revolution in Russia, even though we don't think of it. This is where Stalin had based himself prior to the Russian Revolution. This is where every terrorist organization in Russia descended on Baku, because this was the place where you could do battle with the great capitalist forces, because Baku was the center of capitalism in Russia. And Lev's father, Abraham Nussenbaum, was one of these figures that were then called oil barons. And these were people who went to Baku and made their fortune in oil. They called themselves oil barons. Most of them were local Muslims who sort of discovered oil on their land. Often they were very poor, and they just, you know, happened to, it's sort of like people in Texas in the late 19th century. By the way, Baku was the only competitor to Baku was the United States. It was Standard Oil versus Baku Oil. And Lev's father was an oil millionaire in Baku in 1905, but he had married, unknowingly, he'd married a Russian revolutionary, this very poor woman who actually was in league with Stalin and was selling her jewels to finance the revolution, and was in fact inviting the chief bomb maker of Baku over to family dinners at their house. This gets into other double identities, because this bomb maker was passing himself off as a kind of Russian gentleman. But when all of this came to light, a terrible blow-up occurred between Lev's parents, and Lev's mother committed suicide in this horrible way by drinking acid. It was something that I came to think had to have been a sort of revenge that she took on the family. But this was such a scar on little Lev that this seemed to be sort of the central event of his life. And he blamed his mother and felt guilty for his mother's suicide, as a little boy might. But he also blamed the revolution, and he blamed ideological terrorism, really, to such an extent that he became what he would later call himself, a hater of all revolutions. And Lev Nussenbaum then would go through life taking on this kind of mantle of this Muslim warrior, but a Muslim warrior from the hinterlands who was here to fight the revolutionary forces of the modern West. Ironically, he was somebody who, he came as a Muslim warrior to the West to fight terrorism, which seems a bit odd to us now, but that was really Lev's pose at the time, and it was the reason why he was embraced by so many people, even in Nazi Europe, I think, for reasons we could get into. But basically, he grows up this pampered son of the oil millionaire whose mother has taken her life. He's surrounded by bodyguards wherever he goes, because the terrorism keeps heating up in Baku. There's so many kidnappings and assassinations and bombings. And finally, in 1918, when he's 13 years old, the revolution comes full force to Baku. All the oil millionaires flee for their lives. And the Nussenbaums, oddly enough, instead of fleeing west where any sensible people would go, they hitch a ride on a camel caravan. They escape the Russian Revolution on a camel caravan heading east. And they're ostensibly trying to get to Afghanistan. And they make it almost the way to Afghanistan. They have all these adventures on the caravan through Turkestan, the desert, these vast deserts. And anyway, to sort of abbreviate this journey, they make their way through Persia. Then they can't get into Afghanistan, so they go through Persia and they make their way to Constantinople, which is then the capital of the collapsing Ottoman Empire. And Constantinople is just this crazy mix of East and West. Then it's being occupied by all the Western powers. This is after World War I, and it's also the entire Tsarist army has retreated to Constantinople. So it's this fantastic kind of cultural mix of everything. And also the Ottomans at that moment, this is before Turkey, before Ataturk rose in Turkey and made it into a modern country. There was this kind of forgotten period of Ottoman modernism when the Ottomans were trying to atone for the backwardness of their empire and trying to sort of make things modern. And it was a capital of jazz and all kinds of strange things in the early 1920s that you don't expect. And Lev, when he was 13 years old, fleeing the revolution and all of these horrors he'd seen, fell in love with this kind of wild Ottoman city. And this was the kind of Islam that he wanted to embrace. It was this multicultural sort of collapsing Ottomanism that said you could modernize without taking on some kind of intense ideological position or struggle. So he, as a 13-year-old passing through Constantinople, he can't stay in Constantinople long, and the father says, okay, now we have to go into Europe. And they are, by this point, penniless refugees. They really just have the money they were able to sew into their clothes, and a lot of that has been stolen along the way. And they go into Europe, and they follow the course of a lot of refugees from Tsarist Russia to Germany. Oddly enough, to Germany right before the Nazis, or right as the Nazis are rising to power. And Lev hatches this crazy idea for himself in Constantinople. He says, why should I arrive in Europe as a penniless Jewish refugee, as the lowest of the low at the time, in this very weak position, when I could use these adventures that I've had in the East, these very real, incredible adventures, and use them to kind of create a fictitious identity for myself and arrive and tell people that I am a lost Muslim prince who's been separated from his territories in the East, and I'll even take on a new name. And he transferred his name, Lev or Leo, which means lion. He took it in a Turkish version of it, Esad, which means lion, and he added the words bey, which means sort of mister. So he became Mr. Lion. And this somewhat absurd identity taken on by, you know, a 14, 15-year-old boy, he took it into Weimar Berlin. And over the next 2 years, he managed to perfect this identity and actually then publish his autobiography, which became an international bestseller when he was just 24 years old. And it was based on his adventures, but it was also based on the idea that he was a completely different person than he really had grown up as. He was no longer Lev Nussenbaum. He published his autobiography as Esad Bey. And basically, that takes you to the position where he turned himself into the Indiana Jones of Weimar and Nazi Germany. And the tale only gets stranger, but this is sort of how he managed to pull it off.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you start to think about it, I mean, double identity was a fact of life. I mean, in his own household, his mother had a double identity, and it was also a way to survive, to get through the rough spots.
Oh, so, absolutely. And indeed, I've found a lot of evidence that he learned to take on double identities before he even decided to become, to take on the Muslim identity. He posed as a communist agent to keep himself alive when he was arrested by the communist secret police, then the Cheka, and they were shooting a lot of, most of the people, they certainly would have shot any son of an oil baron if they knew who they had. And Lev actually was able to convince them that he was, in fact, another, he was on a secret mission from another communist agency, sort of disguised as the son of an oil millionaire. So he got himself out of hair-raising situations by taking on poses, and he was very good with languages and very good with sort of making people think he was something he wasn't.
And what precisely was it that he found in Islam? What drew him to Islam?
Yeah, this is what's so fascinating for me about the story. What drew him to Islam at the time, and especially this is at the time of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, which the Ottoman Empire was actually finally brought down by Western invasion. I mean, we don't really think about it, but one of the things that happened after World War One, were in World War One, the main Axis powers were Germany and Austria, and the other one was Turkey, the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottomans didn't really have a long-term connection with the Kaiser or with German power, but a decision had been made to ally with them, and it was a disastrous decision, of course. And so at the end of the war, in addition to, you know, the Versailles settlement against Germany, which gave rise to Hitler, the Allied powers in the West occupied Constantinople with the idea of dismantling the Ottoman Empire and sort of turning it into a series of really Western colonies. Now, that was the moment when Lev arrived there, and what he found in this collapsing Islamic civilization was, I would call it, a profoundly conservative idea at the time. It was an idea of preserving and adapting cultures and ways of living that had been going on for hundreds of years, and it was directly opposed to the currents that were gaining ground in the West, which were the communism on the one hand, and then these various forms of racist extremism like the Nazis or the fascists in Europe, which were all based on the idea that the world needed to be radically transformed and you needed to sweep away the cultures that had been there and create some kind of new utopian culture. And Lev had felt, as we said, had experienced firsthand what this could do to people. I mean, it could, for one thing, it could take away your own mother, and it could make your city this sort of fantastic sort of multicultural, almost a paradise, it seemed, this pre-revolutionary Baku. It could turn it into a terrorist nightmare, which is what happened. I mean, Baku, that was sort of the, if one wanted to look for sort of the origins of Lev's Islamic attraction, I would say it was in the city he was growing up in, which, even though it had its problems, there was something about Baku that made it sort of, you know, a kind of New York or Chicago of that area. It was a place that had very dynamic economic activity, and people of all religions and races there kind of tolerated each other to an extent. It was under the auspices of this Islamic civilization, and as a Jewish boy, of course, growing up in the Tsarist Empire, which was incredibly anti-Semitic everywhere else, the one city in Tsarist Russia of any size that had no significant anti-Semitism or very little was Baku, and that was because the Islamic powers that ruled there just didn't see a reason to persecute Jews.
Journalist Tom Reese is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about his book, The Orientalist, Solving the Mystery of a Strange and Dangerous Life. That life, the life of Lev Nusenbaum. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Your search for Lev Nusenbaum was launched because you were curious about Kurban Said, the author of a novel, Ali and Nino, published in Germany in the 30s. A friend gave you a copy of the book before you were headed off to do a story from Baku in the late 1990s. And this novel is so interesting. I have not read it, but I went and looked for a review of it. And the reviewer says modern readers coming to this novel in the wake of the fall of communism, outbreaks of sectarian violence, and the rise of religious fundamentalism will find disturbing parallels in its cautionary chronicle of cultures colliding and a way of life brutally destroyed.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The way of life brutally destroyed is so, it's something that pervades that little novel. But the novel itself is a Romeo and Juliet story.
Mm-hmm.
It's a love story. In fact, when it was first published in the U.S. in a pocketbooks edition, I always liked this because I have found the old edition. It's got a quote on the cover that says, if Qurban Said can't push Eric Segal off the bestseller list, nobody can. Eric Segal, who was then, you know, best-selling for Love Story.
Love Story, right.
But in fact, it's a much more political tale than Love Story, and it's a love story really across racial and religious boundaries at a time when you can see this multicultural city, Baku, kind of fracturing into ethnic violence and their undercurrents of genocide. And the undercurrents of genocide are all happening because just 2 decades of revolutionary terrorism and 2 decades of really, you know, communist and other kinds of terrorist groups descending on the city have finally created such an unstable situation that the Christians and Muslims and Jews who formerly got along are now starting to be at each other's throats. It's sort of unclear what's going to happen, but there is a feeling that some kind of horrible sectarian violence is going to break out in the city. And remarkably, I mean, Qurban Said is yet another of the false identities or the identities that Lev Nussbaum took on, another one of his ideological or racial Houdini acts, the way I think of it, because it was the last one. It was the one that he took on when he was really on the run from the Gestapo and the fascist secret police in the late 1930s. He decided, I'll take on this new name, Qurban Said, which I found out he took on because it means, it can be translated as joyful sacrifice. And at the time, I think Lev knew darned well that he was going into a situation where he's probably going to lose his life. And he took on this new pen name, Qurban Said, and he wrote this novel of love across racial and religious boundaries. And he publishes it in Germany, in Austrian Germany, in 1937-38. So at the height of the beginning of the Nazi genocide, right before the Holocaust. It actually was quite a controversial book when he published it. And by that point, he couldn't publish anything, even under his other identity, Esad Bey, because he'd been revealed to be a Jew. And so his books were being banned. So Qurban Said was a sort of attempt to take on another identity to keep his books alive for a few more years.
Yeah. So you have this book. You're headed off to Baku. What was it that...
Oh, well, I mean, the stories are there. There are so many sort of mysteries inside mysteries behind how I ended up spending the last 7 years trying to reconstruct the story of this fantastic, seemingly fantastic life that turns out to have been real and indeed more interesting in its truth than in the fictions that he created. But it really started because I went to Baku to write about the oil boom there, the current oil boom, because there's a resurgent oil boom there. And I was given, as you said, this book by Qurban Said, Ali and Nino. And the first thing that fascinated me was I was given it by this Iranian friend who was there sort of prospecting in the oil business. And then I found out that everyone else in Baku would also recommend the book to me. This was sort of the national book of Azerbaijan. And it turned out very quickly that it was clear that no one knew who Qurban Said was. In fact, Qurban Said was a kind of a cipher. No one knew whether it was a man or a woman. And so, I love a mystery. And so the mystery of this grabbed me, first of all. And when I started to put together some of the clues, they were all so contradictory that made it even more interesting. So there was a very strong theory, and it's sort of a theory that is still pursuing me, oddly enough, to this day after I've published The Orientalist, that Qurban Said was, in fact, an Austrian baroness. There's a baroness in Austria in this 15th century castle who insists that her husband's first wife was actually Qurban Said, and has produced all of this documentary evidence. And in fact, it's not completely a fictitious story. In fact, Qurban Said's the publishing contracts for Ali and Nina were signed by this Austrian baroness, Elfriede Ehrenfels. But that was because by the time Levitt had all of these adventures, he had arrived in Austria, and this was probably his lover, or at least his very close friend, and she acted as a kind of affront for him, because by this point the Gestapo knew that, or suspected that Lev Nussbaum, this Jewish man, was behind these Muslim identities, and so she signed his publishing contracts for him. But her descendants have since grown up with the myth that it was in fact their aunt Elfriede who was Qurban Said. But
of all the amazing people you've met,
yes, it's quite interesting. I mean,
unbelievable, and it's also amazing to me how alive for some people this period of history remains to this day. They're very old, but wow.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that was incredible to me was how alive this man had remained to people. This man who was really, you know, world famous in the 1930s, yet by the time I came upon the mystery of him in the late 1990s, he'd really been completely forgotten, or he'd been, it's as though he'd taken on one identity too many. And when he died in 1942 under tragic and mysterious circumstances on the Italian coast, where he was under house arrest by the secret police at the time, after he died, he wasn't ever sort of resurrected, or his works were never reclaimed after the war, as they would have been for almost any persecuted wartime writer, even ones who were much less famous than he was. And he kind of completely disappeared from history. So this was really a challenge in going around the world and trying to, before time ran out, meet anybody who was still alive who might have known him. And the stars, you know, smiled on me in my timing, because wherever I went, I would meet these people who were often in their late 90s, who would come, in the case of one woman who gave me one of my biggest, finds, the things that made this possible, I found his last publisher, Lev's last publisher in Vienna.
Frau Mogel, yeah.
Pardon?
Frau Mogel.
Frau Mogel, exactly. And Frau Mogel, when I found her, even though this woman had a lot to hide because she had been basically a Nazi who had taken over a Jewish publishing house, when she found that I was there to ask about this man of many disguises and many identities, who she had known as Esad Bey and had clearly had a very strong attachment to, she immediately invited me in, and we were sitting in her apartment, and she says, we're talking about him, and she's remembering how wonderful he was and how tragic what happened to him was at the end of his life. And she says, did you ever read his last book? And I said, you mean Ali and Nina? And she says, no, the other book he wrote as Qurban Said, the book called The Man Who Knew Nothing About Love. And I said, no, I've never heard of The Man Who Knew Nothing About Love. And Frau Mogel got up and shuffled over to her closet and came back with these six little leather notebooks about the size of passports, wrapped in a ribbon, and they had actually looked like they had been sitting wrapped in this ribbon possibly for 50 or 60 years in her closet. And these turned out to be the kind of last writing that Lev ever did. It was a novel where he says at the beginning, I am writing this as a novel, but in fact, I want it to be the most truthful thing that I've ever written. I want to tell the truth, finally, about my incredible lives and identities. And wrapped around these notebooks, tied to the ribbon, and this is something I didn't put in the book, because it almost seemed like, again, one of those details that no one would believe me, because it was sort of too perfect, and it was also kind of maybe too sappy, but it almost made me want to cry. She had a little silver locket that she'd been saving with a picture of Lev in a looking like the Orientalist with the fez and the sort of penetrating gaze, sitting in a chair, and that's the picture. If you look at the book now, that's that picture that was in the little locket is the picture that I put on the cover of the book, The Orientalist. But that was just one of many such people who had saved bits of Lev in order that I could come and put them back together somehow.
Yeah. Well, that last work, will it be
it's published?
Will it be published?
Yes, I have great hope that it will. I spent, all of this was such a consuming thing for me. I mean, I've really sort of lived and breathed nothing else for the last few years. After I found those, it took me about a year to translate and transcribe and translate them. I mean, Lev wrote in German most of the time, and luckily I speak German, but he also wrote in this kind of microscopic, almost prison handwriting at the end of his life because he was a prisoner. And so it was very hard and it took a long time, but I have now, it's a kind of 800-page manuscript and it's really quite incredible. And the thing that is equally incredible, I found this in another part of, not in Vienna, but actually in a part of Italy, was his last correspondence, which was a kind of a love letter correspondence that he kept up for 3.5 years with this fascist salon hostess who was the main patron of, believe it or not, the main patron of Ezra Pound, the poet in Italy. And in fact, I was going to say this correspondence and the deathbed notebooks together would make a fabulous book in themselves if someone publishes it. And through the correspondence with that woman, Lev was almost saved. You know, Ezra Pound almost saved Lev's life, and he was just a bit too late, actually. He almost saved Lev's life by getting him actually a gig as a radio host in fascist Italy, but it was just a bit too late for him.
Yeah. Lev's story and the story of this period of history clearly resonate with you, and I think that also very early in the book you write about a relative of yours. This is a very personal story for you, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, my mother was trapped in Nazi Europe as a girl in occupied France, actually. And my mother only survived as a child. I mean, her parents were arrested by the Nazis and killed. And she had to go underground and survived in occupied France by pretending to be a Catholic girl and living on these different farms. And really all of my family came to America on both sides, really, as refugees from Nazi Europe. And I spent a lot of my life, I think, probably like many kids, especially when they first find out about the horrors that went on then, whether they're Jewish or not, or whether they have this direct connection like I have or not, I think I used to fantasize, and I think other people must, about going back and sort of tricking the Nazis. If only I could have gone back and somehow tricked them and saved my grandparents or saved my aunts or, you know, my uncles and all of these wonderful people that I only know through stories. If I could have gone back and through some kind of subterfuge eluded and tricked the Nazis, that was a sort of childhood dream. And then I came upon this true life mystery that as I started to dig into the life of Lev Nussbaum, I found out that in many ways he was really somebody who had the opportunity and the kind of temperament to live out that sort of fantasy. I mean, it ended badly, but the marvels of imagination and sort of courage that it took Lev to keep creating these identities in the face of Nazi Germany when he had many, many opportunities to escape. Unlike, say, people in my family, Lev was an international celebrity in the mid-1930s, constantly being invited to the U.S., making trips to Chicago and New York and Washington and Hollywood. And he kept choosing to go back to Nazi Europe, where he continued to sort of live his elaborate triple life.
Yeah, and when he married, he kept his identity secret, right?
Yes, from his wife.
Yeah.
And in fact, that caused a tremendous explosion in this tabloid divorce when his wife told his, some parts of his story are incredibly funny, even if they have a tragic edge when his wife divorced him and it became a kind of tabloid war between the European tabloids that sympathized with Lev Esad, who was a celebrity there, and the American tabloids that sympathized with the wife, whose father was a budding Hollywood mogul. The American tabloids, especially the New York Daily News, was supporting the wife, and one of my favorite quotes was she said to them, you know, when he married me in Berlin, he said he was a Muslim princeling, but after our marriage, I found out he was just plain old Leo Nissenbaum, and she wanted to get rid of him. It wasn't good enough to be married to plain old Leo Nissenbaum. She'd clearly been sort of seduced by the Muslim desert adventurer pose.
Another very strange turn in the story. Going back to the history that is here.
Yes.
We talked about oil in Baku from the point of what the very first oil boom, and to the oil boom that you went to write about in 1998 that continues. You know, this is another fascinating piece of the story. The first oil boom fueled Stalin's programs, and Hitler wanted Baku.
That's right. Hitler, in some ways, Hitler may have lost the Second World War because he was so obsessed with Baku oil. The Battle of Stalingrad, it's unclear, but the Nazis would have done better in the Battle of Stalingrad if they had pulled out of the Caucasus Mountains all of these elite troops that they had sent there to try to get over the mountains and capture Baku. Because as Hitler would scream to his generals in 1942, if we capture Baku, then the entire the bridge between Europe and Asia, between East and West, will be ours, and also the most strategic resource in the world. We will be able to starve the Allies of oil, because they would have had Baku oil, and also Baku is on this narrow land bridge. If you control that, then you control really it's a way to sweep into the Middle East from Russia.
Mm. You had to have learned a great deal about the history of this period in your research. Besides, I don't know if the oil story came as a surprise, but what was the greatest surprise along the way in your research?
Well, it's connected to the oil story. What really surprised me most was the way that this period that Lev grew up in 100 years ago kind of bizarrely seems to parallel our own period, and I say that hoping that it doesn't continue to parallel our own period, that we don't lead ourselves into a couple of world wars. But there was this sense, Lev grew up in 100 years ago at a time when terrorism was considered actually the greatest problem in the world at the time that Lev was. This is before World War One and before the Russian Revolution. There was a wave of terrorism sweeping the Western countries. Theodore Roosevelt, when he became president, said in his speech, his predecessor had been assassinated by a terrorist, and he gave this invade against terrorism as the great threat that needed to be conquered. And certainly in the Tsarist Empire, it was even much, much more so. And it was so interesting to me the way that in attempting to deal with that problem, the people of the time ended up getting themselves into far worse problems, that sort of the solutions to terrorism, say, in Tsarist Russia, only led to a kind of really state-run terrorism that was much, much worse, because it led to the communist takeover. And then it was also fascinating to me to follow Lev's journey from east to west and to see a whole side to the rise of Nazism that I had never really contemplated, which was both the importance of again, terrorism in Germany in the 1920s in kind of polarizing the society, and also this is before the Nazis had taken power, just in sort of creating this atmosphere of fear and killing a lot of the most reasonable people and making people afraid to speak their minds, and also the whole way that so much of the influence of anti-Semitism and the racial hatred on the Nazis and on Hitler had come often with Russian refugees, refugees from the communist revolution, who were filled with bitterness and feeling that a kind of world conspiracy had been done by the Jews and that that's what brought down Russia. But I guess what it left me with was this feeling that civilization is so fragile, and that in some ways Lev's pose has a good deal of sense behind it, that it's not such a bad thing to be a hater of all revolutions as he meant it, to be a hater of the idea that you can kill people for ideological ends, because it will only lead to more and more violence.
There we have to leave it, and I think that's a nice way of ending this afternoon. Tom Rees, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me on, Celeste.
Tom Rees has been my guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Look for his book, The Orientalist, Solving the Mystery of a Strange and Dangerous Life. The book is published by Random House, and there's a website associated with the book, www.theorientalist.info. And Tom Rees joined us this afternoon, the afternoon of March 10th, 2005, from Chicago, where this evening he'll be at 57th Street Books for a reading and a book signing. So if you're listening in the Chicago area and you'd like to meet the author and talk with him, you can do that. Tom Rees has been our guest this afternoon. Again, the title of the book, The Orientalist, the publisher, Random House. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, futures finished the day like this in the wheat pit after the World Ag Supply and Demand Estimates were released by USDA this morning. Futures in the wheat pit moving higher, up 6.5 cents in the nearby March contract to 340. Their settlement price once again up 6.5 for the day. Let's start over with those just real quickly. I don't think we had ourselves potted up just high enough. We'll take a look at those numbers again. World Ag Supply and Demand Estimates were released this morning by USDA. And the numbers we'll get to during the closing market report when we talk with Dan Zwicker of AgriVisor Services in Bloomington, Illinois. Here's the way the numbers finished at the Board of Trade after that release this morning. March wheat futures finished 6.5 cents higher. They had a high today of 340, a low at 329.5, and a settlement price there at $3.40 a bushel, up 6.5. May contract now, 348.5 the high, the low at 334. Settlement price at 348, up 7.25. And July futures for the day, 356 the high, the low at 341. Settlement price at 355, and they were up 7.5 on the day. September contract in the wheat pit for the day, 360.5 the high, the low at 348.5, a settlement price at 360.25, up 7.25. And December wheat at 368.5 high, the low there, $3.56, settled at 368. They were up 7 for the day. From the corn pit now, the March contract at 212.75 high, the low at 207. Settlement price at $2.12.5, up 3.25 on the day. May futures at 220.5 high, low at 214.5. And settled at $2.20 even. They were up 3.75 for the May corn. July futures, 227.5 high, low at 221.5. Settled at $2.27, up 3.75 in the July. The September contract, the settlement price at 233.25, up 3.25, with a high of 33.75 and a low at 28 cents even. December corn futures, 242.5 the high, the low at 236.5, and a settlement for your new crop at 241.5, up 3 cents. March futures, 248.5, the high, the low at 242.75, settled at 247.25, and they were up 2.5 for the day. From the oat pit now, unchanged in the nearby contract, with a high of 175.5 for the March, the low at 175.5, settlement price there at 175.5 as well, all unchanged for the day. May futures, a 155.5 high, low at 153, settled at 155.25, and they were up 0.5 in the May oats. From the soy complex, nearby beans up 9.25 cents, the high today at 633.5, the low at $6.20, settled 633.25, up 9.25 for the day. May futures for the day, 640 the high, the low at 625, settled at 639.25, they were up 9.75. And July beans, 644 the high, the low at 629.5, a settlement price there at 643, and they were up 9 for the day. August contract in the bean pit now, 643 the high, the low at 628, settled $6.41, up 9.5 cents. September futures, 630.5 the high, the low at 620. settled 629 and three quarters, up 8 3/4. And the November soybeans, 625 the high, the low at 615, settled 624.5. They were up 9 on the day. March bean meal, 185.10 the high, the low at 8181. Settled 185.10, up 3.40. And the May bean meal, 189 the high, the low at 184.50. Settlement price at 188.80, up 3.40. Now the bean oil. March contract, 23.60 the high, the low at 23.20. Settled 23.55, and they were off 5 cents for the day. And the May bean oil, 23.78 the high, the low at 23.31. Settlement price at 23.66. And they finished 2 higher. I'll be back at 6 after the hour with the closing market report. We'll talk to Dan Zwicker about those WASD numbers, the World Ag Supply and Demand Estimates, at that time. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. A mostly lower day today on the Merc. March feeder cattle 106 even, the high 105.27.5, the low, the settlement 105.55, that down 32.5. April 105.95, the high 104.77.5, the low, the settlement 105.37.5, that down 30. May feeder cattle 104.95, the high 103.90, the low, the settlement 104.80, that up a nickel. April live cattle 91.55, the high 90.60, the low 90.70, the settlement, that down 75. June 87.05, the high 86.35. The low, the settlement, 86.72.5, that down 77.5. April lean hog, 73.80, the high, 72.57.5, the low, finishing at 72.57.5, that down, the limit down $2. May, 77.10, the high, 75.55, the low, 75.75, the settlement, that down 180. June, 80.10, the high, 78.85, the low, 78.92.5, the settlement, that down 172.5. July lean hog, 77.30, the high, the low, 76.40, the settlement, 76.67.5, that down 95. March bellies, 86.05, the high, 84.60, the low, the settlement, 85.50, that down 80. And the Dow is currently up 48 points at 10,853.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Karen Falkenberger from Oshawa, Ontario writes, "Dear Dr. Science, which city in the world has the greatest number of bridges, and how many is that?"
That would be Lake Havasu City, Arizona, home of the London Bridge. Now, when and why all the world's great bridges began migrating toward that desert town is still a mystery, but bridgeologists predict by the year 2525, all of the world's bridges will span the dry gulch that